I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. Tonight's show was taped live on Sunday night at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. I moderated a panel called Come Home America. Come Home America is an anti-war movement that's working to create a dialogue between left and right, between the progressive anti-war movement and the conservative writers and activists who oppose the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Both groups sit outside and are locked out of the mainstream conversation in America's media. It's a decidedly anti-Obama as it was an anti-Bush conversation. So what you're about to hear is a dialogue, as I said, that I moderated, Busboys and Poets, in Washington, D.C., between those who believe the right and the left should come together to end the wars. Now, we strive to bring all kinds of voices to our program, the popular and the unpopular, the outsiders in our political conversation, as well as the usual insiders. So I invite you to listen and respond to me at mark@steinershow.org with your ideas and comments, and chew on this, what you hear on the air today. The guests on the panel are consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, conservative political writer Kelly Vlahos, progressive activist Kevin Zeese, and editor of the American Conservative, Daniel McCarthy. First, we turn this over to WEAA traffic to check on the roads to make sure you know which way to go in the Baltimore area. Then we'll be right back with our Come Home America panel. Stay with us. Welcome to Busboys and Poets. I'm Mark Steiner, and we have a panel here. What we're going to talk about, this is called Come Home America. And one of our panelists, Kevin Zeese, who has been a guest on my show many times, put this idea together, which is to create a dialogue between right and left, especially around war issues, to see where we are, what we have in common, what we don't, and what it might mean for the future, what it might mean for our political process. So our panel tonight, and by the way, there's a microphone in the audience, let me tell you that, which is, where is it?
Oh, Margaret has it.
Margaret has it. As we get the discussion started, we really want you to participate, join us, your thoughts and questions, that'll be part of this discussion as well. So our panelists are, let me introduce the folks who are with us here today. To my extreme right, I don't necessarily mean this is politically, we're just talking about where we're sitting at the moment, is Kelly Vlahos, who is a writer for antiwar.com and Fox News. Joins us, good to see you, Kelly, and Vlahos. To her left is Kevin Zeese, who is with Come Home America, many other movements, is building a movement we'll talk about during the course of the evening about demonstrations in October to bring it home to America. To my far left is Daniel McCarthy, probably not, but the editor of the American Conservative, which as a magazine in the conservative world stood up early to say no to the Iraq War. And to his right, to my left, is Ralph Nader. So we got that clear? All right. So one of the things we're going to try to do is go through this discussion with all five of us, all four of our guests here, to kind of explore what this really means, because in our country, questions of war and not going to war have really fluctuated a lot between right and left in America. From the days of the Civil War, when progressives, people we would consider progressives today, wanted war, even more than the South did. And there was a lot of resistance on the part of more conservative Democrats and Republicans to say, we don't want a war to take place.
They were the Whigs in those days.
By the what?
The Whigs.
The Whigs that became the Republicans. And things shifted many, many times over the years. The left again, some of it, pushed for World War II, against the Korean War. And I remember very vividly when a lot of us were fighting the Vietnam War, getting drafted to go fight in Vietnam, that it tore the country asunder, but also tore the movements asunder. On the conservative side, Young Americans for Freedom split over that war, with libertarians saying no to the war and others supporting both Johnson and Nixon in the war. So this has always been a back-and-forth battle, but what do we mean by being anti-war? How do conservatives and people on the left unite around that issue if they can? Are our agendas different in terms of why we oppose these wars? And what we would do if the wars ended magically, if it did come home to America, what would happen then? What do you do with the money that we're not spending on those wars? So, and since Kevin, since you are the one who kind of created this,
With others,
but this came from you originally. So why don't you begin us off on what you think this moment means, because we're seeing now in America where both conservative and progressive Democratic members of Congress are pushing the president, suing the president over the War Powers Act. We're seeing people from right and left, and now the mayor's conference in Baltimore, from Republican mayors to Democratic mayors, have voted to ask the wars to end and to bring the money back to America. So there is something bubbling up. Kevin Zeese.
Yeah, I get what helped us get this started, and it was not just me, it was a bunch of other people who joined in to start this, was a recognition that really neither the left or the right who opposed war could do this and end the wars alone. The military-industrial complex and the instinct to go to war is something that's deeply embedded in the American political system. And we saw during the Bush era, before the invasion of Iraq, we saw massive demonstrations, probably the largest demonstrations before any war. And it didn't make any difference. The reason was because it was a left anti-war movement, and Bush didn't get those votes no matter what he did. So he could ignore that. Now, if at that time period we had had a cross-partisan anti-war movement where President Bush saw some of his voters out there, he might actually listen to us. And we can see most recently with the Libyan war and the funding of that, how close we've come recently and finally last week succeeded in the House voting to end funding of the Libyan war. More Republicans voted for that than Democrats did. So, that didn't get much media attention. But our view is that we need to unite around this issue of ending militarism as our prime area of foreign policy, and that's the only way we're going to end it. And there's no question we disagree on other issues, but once you start to work, my experience is working across political barriers, is once you start to work together on something you agree on, you can actually listen to each other on areas you disagree, and both learn from each other and each improve their policy perspective. So I think this is useful, not just for ending war, but when we get to issues like corporate welfare and crony capitalism, we'll find agreement. Civil liberties, we'll find agreement. The Patriot Act. We'd probably find agreement on Bradley Manning and how he's being treated, on transparency in government. So there's a lot of areas where we'll find agreement beyond ending war and empire. But I think that this is a very strong area to start. If we can bring these cross, partisan, cross-political perspective views together, we can have an impact. And so that's we did this because we saw what we were doing was not working, and we knew that doing the same thing over and over again would continue not to work. And so we want to actually succeed. And so that's why we brought people together.
I think, Dan, let me turn to you for a moment, because I think that a number of people may have heard of the American Conservative magazine, others have not, or that you opposed wars from the beginning. I think it'd be interesting to kind of explore that from your political perspective, why you opposed and your organization opposed the Iraq War from the beginning.
Sure. Well, if you go back to the 1990s, I think you found that, in fact, you had coalescing both on the right and also individually on the left, a number of movements that were very critical of the stance that the U.S. had towards the world after the Cold War. So, for example, not only did Ralph Nader run in 2000 representing perhaps a more genuinely American kind of movement than what Al Gore was representing, and where Gore seemed to want to perpetuate a lot of Clinton-era sort of world policing actions, but also on the right, you had Patrick J. Buchanan, who was running as an America First candidate, as someone who thought that now that the Cold War was over, it was time to close down a lot of our bases around the world, stop treating Russia as an enemy, and really start to focus again on issues right here at home. So it was, I think a disappointment to everyone when George W. Bush, but it would have been just as bad, of course, if Al Gore had taken power. Either way, the American people were going to lose, and they did lose. And, of course, Bush was the one who wound up taking power. And then once he had that, he began pursuing not just a foreign policy, but any number of policies, even here at the domestic front, that were going to be extremely deleterious to the public. So the American Conservative got started as a magazine in 2002, really to oppose not only Bush's foreign policy agenda, especially his rush to war in Iraq, but also to raise questions about things he was doing at home as well. In 2003, for example, we had a cover story criticizing the housing bubble. So I think there are broad areas here where people who are thinking, trying to think independently and think from principle, both on the left and on the right, are coming to a lot of conclusions that are very critical of the political mainstream and establishment, whether it's Republican or Democratic.
Kelly, let me turn to you.
Well, I agree with everything that Dan just said.
Not with me?
And you too. I think that the left is coming to a really scary realization now, and maybe this has been over the last couple of years under the Obama administration, that anti-war liberals are misfit, just like the American conservative and the conservatives that ascribe to the anti-war ideal during the Bush years were misfit. And we're both sides feel like that, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, when they had those Island of Misfit Toys, and we're waiting for some politician to come in and save us, like Santa Claus, Santa, come back and save us. And I think at this moment, I think we're at a crucial, critical moment where we realize that no politician is going to save us at this point. We're going into another presidential election cycle under war, where after this summer, it's going to go full throttle in the media, presidential election, the war, and all of these intellectual and ideological arguments are going to go away, and it's going to be he said, she said, find your corners, be in your corners, fight for your guy, fight for your gal, and all of this moment is going to be lost. And I think that at this point, we need to work together. And maybe it's not about electing officials anymore. Maybe there's another solution. I've been thinking about this, just over the weekend about what I was going to say today, and I think the biggest obstacle that we have, the left and the right, is the corporate media. We can't seem to get our message out. The template was framed from the beginning after 9/11. You're either with us or against us, and that hasn't gone away, whether it's Bush or Obama. So if you are a right-wing or a left-wing anti-war activist, you have no place. You're still misfit. You are unpatriotic. You're not with the program. And until we find a way to bust through that, and I don't know what the answer is, but I think that if we help each other, that might be a step forward in terms of promoting each other and not being afraid that, Susie over here is with a left-wing organization. I disagree with her on the economy and how to fix Medicare, so somehow she's kind of weird, and I don't know if I can work with her. Or Bob over there is a libertarian, and he wants to get rid of, institutions that I support. I don't know if I want to work with him. I think that, like Kevin was saying, that we can transcend that, and the more that we work together, we might find that having that healthy debate might be fun. But right now we need to work on the war stuff, and I think we need to promote each other in the media, or start somewhere.
Now, Ralph, you've been battling this thing for a long time. I'm very curious to see if your thoughts, because you've been battling actually from the left.
This is a new movement, it seems.
Well, this is an interesting audience here tonight, Mark, because here, for example, Oliver Hall is the director of the Center for Competitive Democracy, which is dedicated to multi-party candidates, reducing ballot access barriers, and giving voice to the kind of issues that the two-party dictatorship or two-party oligopoly excludes. And the Presidential Debate Commission is a perfect example of that. And then there's Russell Mulcahy, who's the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, and the issue, again, unifies left and right, cracking down on corporate crime, just the way they want to crack down on street crime. Wall Street should not be exempted from that rigor. So I think that the views represented here on the criminality of wars of aggression, which violate our Constitution because they're not declared, they violate federal statutes, they violate the Geneva Convention treaties that we are signatory to, and they violate the UN Charter. I think these views represent a majority of the American people. The problem is that when this majority view tries to affect the two parties, it's shoehorned into oblivion. And the two parties, in effect, destroy this emerging body of political opposition to these wars. And you can see the Obama administration, it can be called the Obama-Bush administration. He has, with very few exceptions, expanded all the outrages of George W. Bush that liberals and progressives excoriated before 2009. For example, Guantanamo is still there. They say they're doing, or they do not reject extraordinary rendition. They're using state secrets as a defense against the right to hold the government accountable by people who have been clearly abused and tortured. They are into Libya and Yemen and Afghanistan and Pakistan and any other country, because the Obama doctrine is they'll go anywhere in the world and destroy anybody they think is a threat to this country. In other words, the executive branch is now the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner. And as far as drones go, far worse than Bush, as far as the Obama doctrine in its overt declaration that they'll even do this to any American citizen anywhere in the world is beyond what Bush did. So the real challenge is that both parties have nullified in foreign and military policy the Constitution, federal laws, even down to the Army Field Manual. They've unleashed agencies that have fewer and fewer boundaries, like the FBI, which has been in the news lately. And they have told the world that the boundaries of international law, containment of military force to self-defense basically are the subject of unbridled discretion, whatever Obama says. Now, you can see this in the Libyan situation today. You have George Will excoriating Obama in the Washington Post. I've written a column, this is on Common Dreams, where I noted that the editors of the Harvard Law Review should be rolling over in their footnotes, since one of their celebrated predecessors, Barack Obama, is making a mockery out of the rule of law. And we're not talking about shades of gray or penumbrans or possible interpretations that differ of the law. This is about as clear a violation as possible. And when you do that, you've got to go into the Orwellian dictionary. And here is what Obama says gets him out of obeying the War Powers Resolution and the Declaration Authority of Congress, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Here's what he calls daily bombing of Libya, drones over Libya, blowing up Gaddafi's compound, tent encampment, a total naval blockade against Gaddafi. Here's what the official description of this is to get out of his obligation, his sworn obligation to obey the law. He said basically that these are, quote, time-limited, scope-limited military action, end quote. Namely, they don't rise to the level of hostilities envisioned by the War Powers Resolution. And the American people are powerless to do anything about it because they are thrown out of court on the doctrine of no standing to sue. Congress has been an ink blot, although stirring itself a little bit. So that countervailing power is not been working. And the two parties will not make the wars a major issue in the coming presidential campaign. And they have excluded third parties from debates and from any kind of participatory role on issues that would be anti-war, especially.
So I'm curious, a couple of things you raised here. And I'm going to spoil them a little bit more depth. I mean, A, is there unanimity of a thought right and left on this panel as represented, on why we shouldn't be at war? Is there?
My suspicion is there's a lot of overlap. I think we all recognize it's not good for our national security, not good for our economic security, it's not good for the rule of law, not good for democracy. We're killing civilians. We're doing all sorts of damage around the world. So I think we'd agree on all that. I think some progressives oppose war, but like on Libya, for example, there are a number of anti-war activists who actually support the Libyan invasion. That it was humanitarian. They bought the humanitarian line. I think a lot of those have backed off that since they've seen how it's been actually implemented and have come to recognize it's not a humanitarian war. We just killed a bunch of civilians yesterday in Tripoli to protect civilians. People are seeing that. But I think there's probably on the right, and people on the right can correct me, there's a stronger non-intervention perspective of all sorts. I think on the left, I hate that left-right terminology, but I'm using it, but there is not a total non-intervention perspective. I think there are some on the left who would you know, see funding of building economies around the world, of raising standards, living around the world, being things that they'd want the United States involved in. So there are some differences, but I think there's a lot of similarities, and that's what dominates.
Dan?
Well, I mean, there are actually quite a lot of gradations on the right as well. So, for example, you've seen that Gary Johnson, who's one of the presidential contenders in the Republican Party this year, even though he's generally a non-interventionist, he, too, had a kind of wobbly, you know, sometimes humanitarian intervention is justified perspective. I don't think he applied that to Libya, but he has said in a couple of interviews that he does favor certain kinds of humanitarian efforts. And there is an argument to be made in sort of traditional Christian or Roman Catholic just law theory for some kinds of limited humanitarian engagements. I am very critical of all those things because I think that it's very, very difficult to justify them given the kinds of circumstances that we've actually seen over the last 50 years or so in most of the wars that we've engaged in. Similarly, you also have a division within realists, and there is you know, a certain sort of conservative perspective which looks at things purely from the perspective of a national interest as opposed to a more universal moral horizon. And there, too, you see some divisions. You see that some people think, well, if you could have a very limited intervention that would be, you know, as short as Barack Obama was promising with the Libyan war, of course, it hasn't turned out to be short at all, that something like that could be justified. And again, I'm very critical of that point of view, but I do want to allow that actually, even on the non-interventionist right, there are these gradations between people who are pure non-interventionists and those who are either offshore balancers or who even allow the you know, a little bit of crack in the door for humanitarian interventions.
I mean, Kelly, unless you want to jump in. I mean, we even see...
Yeah. Well, just to answer your question. The Iraq war was based on lies, cover-ups, and deceptions. That's generally fact now. So that wasn't necessary. No weapons of mass destruction, no connection with al-Qaeda in Iraq, no threat to the U.S., et cetera. He was once our ally when he was anti-communist. And, the issue was largely oil and the geopolitics of the region. Afghanistan, you don't blow a country apart in order to pursue certain suspected backers of the attackers on 9/11. I mean, that is crazy. I mean, look what's happened. Afghanistan was given, under the Taliban, $40 million by the U.S. government in the spring of 2001, for eradicating the poppy trade. What's the result now of our invasion? It's the number one narco state in the world, and that's all they have in their GDP for the farmers to survive. It's provoked all kinds of sectarian battles. We've lost soldiers, injured more soldiers, blown apart families here, disruptions, traumatic syndrome is going to be with us in economic and psychological and physical costs for decades. It was the wrong way to pursue, say, suspected backers of the attackers. It also spilled over into Pakistan and raised even greater specters of disaster. And, of course, the Taliban is being funded by the U.S. taxpayer. The Taliban says, we're not going to let your oil trucks through the passes unless we get paid. The Taliban is raking off money from the poppy trade. The Taliban is engaging in all kinds of $100 transactions or extortions with the U.S. military. I mean, what's going on there is not being reported very widely. But it's a disaster, just the way Iraq was for the Iraqi people and for our country. Now in Yemen, the same thing happens. You go in, you have tribal conflicts, you get anarchy, you get sectarian struggle, and you have more fertile ground for more young men to hate us and to organize together against us. And now in Libya, had we done it in a different way, you don't do it by having Western nations called NATO attack Libya. You don't do it that way. First of all, Libya never attacked any single NATO nation. And, of course, the U.S. is bearing the economic brunt of that attack. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it when you're dealing with massacres like Rwanda and elsewhere is you have a well-equipped United Nations peacekeeping force under the United Nations authority, and so it can move under certain international law criteria and can't be accused of being a partisan Western nation, imperialism, colonialism, and all the rest of it.
Kelly, I'm curious, that last part that Ralph said.
The UN?
Yeah.
About the UN? I kind of want to link to a thought that I had about, you know, when it kind of includes the UN as well. I think that we need to be careful. And I'd like to, you know, and I don't want to sound condescending, but, you know, to people on the left as well as the right, when we heard a lot of, during the Obama 2008 presidential debate, there were a lot of talk about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you had to listen carefully. They weren't talking about the root of the war, the reasons why we're there. The reasons that Mr. Nader just spoke about, they were talking about doing it differently. And what happened was a lot of the advisors that were working for Hillary Clinton's campaign, Obama's campaign, John Edwards' campaign, came from this liberal interventionist field of Democrats who believed that there was a place for preemptive war. And it had more to do with, they believed, a humanitarian need than what they saw as the right's, you know, need for greed. And so when Barack Obama was elected, he decided to shun the few non-interventionists, the real ones, Susan Rice, Tony Lake, and others who had actually shown some concern and some... They showed some opposition to the Iraq war and the reasons why we're there. He put them in places where you don't hear from them very often. Even, you know, Susan Rice, she holds a very powerful position, but she's not here, you know, at the levers of power in Washington. Instead, he hired all of these Clinton types who had been, you know, promoting this liberal interventionism, you know, from the Clinton days, you know, Yugoslavia, Madeleine Albright, Richard Holbrooke, the whole band. People who had been sort of like, you know, cooling their heels in academia, writing about things about taking the UN and using it as a tool to go out and spread democracy and make the world in the American image. And that was sort of under the radar. So when people express surprise about Obama's apparent change of heart about the war, they have to look at who he hired the month after he was inaugurated. He hired, you know, the sort of the Clinton enterprise came back to Washington. I'm afraid that we're seeing a little bit of that now when we're talking about this sort of change of heart among Republicans in the Congress, the Tea Party members who have come in on the wave of the last election who are now expressing opposition to Afghanistan. You have to listen to what they're saying. Are they saying that we shouldn't be... In Afghanistan for the real bedrock reasons that Mr. Nader just talked about, or they just don't like how the war is being waged. And I think, you know, I want to believe that there is something going on in the House right now that might lead us to getting out sooner, an accelerated withdrawal, but I don't think that we should put too much stock in some of these Republicans who are coming forward now in opposition to the war.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back with more from our Come Home America panel, taped live at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. on Sunday night. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Tonight's show was taped live on Sunday night at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. Now let's go back to our discussion. Let me see this. So all right, here we have a situation in America now where you're seeing folks like Congressman Jones suing the president, Bartlett, a very libertarian conservative member from Maryland, in that fold, people like Kucinich and Conyers opposing this war and pushing it in the House. We talked about what the mayors are doing, voting resolutions saying end the wars, bring the money back to America. and there is that kind of groundswell happening, but most Americans, when you ask them what they care about, it's not the war. What most Americans care about is the economy, is their fear of losing their job, is the mortgage crisis. I mean, that's what's fueling most Americans' fear in their hearts at the moment. So,
well, of course, the war and the economy are tightly linked.
That's about to be my question. So here we have people on this panel who I will assume have very different perspectives on what you do with the American economy.
Right.
I would probably bet that's true. So the question is, how do you make the leap you just talked about? Because no one has been able really to make that connection in a mass way among American people, right or left, or anywhere in the middle, that about the economy and the war. It's always talked about, but the connection is never really made in the grassroots gut level of America.
Let's assume one of the major parties decided to say, if we get out of Iraq, Afghanistan, stop policing the world, and increasing our own insecurity because of the boomeranging of what we're doing over there and blowing apart the people over there, if we took all that money and put it down to rebuilding what the American Society of Civil Engineers said is the infrastructure, the clinics, the libraries, the public buildings, schools, bridges, public transit, that would connect with the mayors and that would create jobs. But you see, as long as the leadership of the Republican and Democratic Party will not raise these issues, and they haven't so far, this rebellion you just talked about, Mark, was the second level. It's not Boehner, it's not Reid,
right,
et cetera. As long as they don't make it a political issue, they don't make it an electoral issue, as long as we don't have freedom for third parties to get on the debates and make it an issue, it's not going to happen. Even if you have 80% of the people against what's happened in Libya, that's the latest poll, and you have a majority against Afghanistan, and if you polled the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan, I'll guarantee you, a majority say we should get the heck out of there, just as a January 2005 poll of Iraq soldiers, American soldiers in Iraq, had over 70%. January 2005 saying we should get out of Iraq in 6 to 12 months, it doesn't make any difference, because the Khyber Pass, to use the metaphor, is controlled by the two-party oligarchy or oligopoly or dictatorship, you name it. And I cannot see any light at the end of the tunnel when you talk to progressives, liberals, authentic conservatives, and libertarians. And they say, we're against these wars, we want to come back home, but we're going to vote for a Republican or Democrat who are for these wars and don't want to come home. Then the burden is on the voters to explain why they keep voting for politicians who are against what they stand for and not breaking their routine and voting independent or voting for a third party, or at least telling the pollsters in April or May that they're going to do that just to put some pressure on the two parties.
But let me ask you all, I mean, take that a step further, though, and that's supposed to be a no-fly zone. It's not working. Sorry. I mean, to take it a step further, though, I mean, if we, I hear what you're saying, Ralph, yeah, but take it for a moment outside the electoral arena, all right? People run outside the two mainstream parties all the time, and then things go on. The question is, what does this mean, the spectrum of people on this panel, what you all represent, what it represents in terms of most Americans who don't like the wars we're in, but are also more concerned about the economy? They're not marching on Washington to end the wars. So the question is, I mean, we don't have a draft like we did in 67, 68, where it fueled people's passion against the war. So the question is, what happens? What does this mean? And how do you respond to it to the American people?
To me, what it means is we can't trust either of these parties. We can't trust that these politicians, even the ones who are now voting against Libyan funding, are going to stay that way unless we have an independent political movement that continues to demand it. It's all about building independent movements. And that's one thing good about the left-right movement, because if we get a Republican in, that will help to keep the anti-war pressure on. If we get a Democrat in, the other side will help to keep pressure on. We need to work together to keep focused and not be fooled by these politicians, because anyone who listened to President Obama in the last election If you listen closely, he was favoring a bigger military, a bigger war in Afghanistan. He was in favor of attacking Pakistan, chasing terrorists everywhere. What he is doing, he has done. He said he was going to do, including keeping the Iraq war going. He just said he ended combat. We have 50,000 troops and 50,000 mercenaries there ending combat. So everything he's done, he's said. And it's becoming more and more clear that this is connected to the economy. One thing the two-party dictatorship agrees on in Congress and the White House is that off the table when we have this budget deficit is funding for the security state. That's 66% of the budget, makes up of the war, the militarism, intelligence, and domestic security. And that's off the table. Everything else is on the table. And if we just put the money that we could save from wars into the basics of government, the infrastructure that Ralph described, we could spend trillions of dollars, and that's funding that everyone across the political spectrum in this debate would agree with, because that's the basics of government. That's infrastructure, that's bridges, that's roads, that's, you know, all the stuff that we need just to have the economy work is falling apart before our eyes because the war funding is sucking out of the economy. And that's why the mayors, for the first time yesterday, came out since the Vietnam War, first time since the Vietnam War, coming out against continuing the wars. And so we're seeing some things happening.
What were you about to say, Kelly?
Well, I don't want to be the harbinger of bad news, but we should talk about the bad news too. And I think, you know, just to go along with what Mr. Nader was talking about in terms of the sort of the Khyber Pass on at Capitol Hill, you know, war critic that I talked to had actually done a summation of all the numbers of people who are involved in the military-industrial complex. He calls it the American Tribal Confederacy. It's not just the military and the people who serve in active duty. It's their families. It's the reserves. It's the National Guard. It's all their families. It's everybody in the defense contracting industry and their families and the contractors. And he added up to about 25 million people whose personal interest is in seeing the military-industrial complex thrive, continue, and get funded at the federal level. So I think that is a major obstacle, too.
No question.
Now, you talk about the mayors. I think that what we're going to see here is some sort of clash. You're going to see a clash between, you know, governors and mayors of cities and states whose the majority of their economies do not, you know, subsist off the military-industrial complex. But what's that set up? Does that set up, you know, antagonistic the fights and political battles between states all of a sudden, because you have states like, say, South Carolina or North Carolina or Texas or Colorado where you have massive, you know, U.S. bases where you have flourishing towns and cities that subsist off of the military. So I think that's one big obstacle, as well as the obstacle in Washington, in which Mr. Nader was right. I mean, if you look at the key committees of foreign, you know, foreign relations, the armed services, and those leaders are not going to budge.
Well, that's a conflict. Support. That's a conflict we have to have. The conflict with the military-industrial complex is one we have to face up to and have to have. And I think when we have that conflict, you know, especially if the right and left is united, and that's what the idea of Come Home America is. The website's comehomeamerica.us. Check it out and get involved. The idea is to bring people together to challenge that military-industrial complex, because when you look at the facts, the military-industrial complex is not good for the economy. If you want to spend $1 billion to create jobs, the military is about the worst way to do it. There have been studies on this. Ahead of spending on that, infrastructure is one of the biggest, most successful ways to create jobs. Building mass transit is the most successful way. Spending on education is equivalent to infrastructure. Even tax cuts, which are not very effective, are more effective than the military-industrial complex in creating jobs. So we can have a better economy if we focus it away from the military weapons and war spending, because that's very expensive and very wasteful. And so let's have that conflict. Let's make that conflict happen. Let's bring people together and face up to that conflict and make this a debate in the United States. Do we want to be a military-industrial-based economy or an economy based on what people need?
Dan, I just got to reply to Kevin on this. It's not just the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address. It's the military-industrial presidential congressional complex.
Sure.
President Obama, the lawless president of the land of the free, home of the brave, is spending now up to $1 billion on the Libya war that has not been appropriated. Not a cent has been appropriated for that war. That's a pretty serious violation. That's an impeachable offense.
That's right.
The problem is that the Pentagon budget every year is decreed to be unauditable by the Government Accountability Office of the U.S. Congress. They just, you know, they go through the routine. They say, this budget, which is now $800 billion, is unauditable. That's how Obama gets away with shifting this kind of money. But even Bush didn't do it as badly as that. Bush would send up $50 billion every once in a while for Iraq and Afghanistan for a rubber stamp. So it's getting worse by the year. And we must understand that it was the neocons, it was civilians, it was the White House that pushed the Pentagon into Iraq up to the four-star level. The U.S. Army was against the invasion of Iraq. They saw no strategic reason. They knew there were lies. And they knew there was no after plan after toppling Saddam. It was the neocons and Bush and Cheney, draft dodgers of yesteryear, wanting someone else to fight their pro-Vietnam War cause. That's what pushed it in. So we should not try to isolate the Pentagon here and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. They have become part of a very powerful quadrangle, which includes the President and the Congress. And while we can't do anything directly on the Pentagon or on the defense industry, we certainly can do something from the grassroots up on the Congress and the presidency.
So, Dan, take again from this conservative perspective what we've just talked about. What is that appeal? How does it work?
Well, I should actually introduce a rather complicating factor. I totally agree with Ralph, by the way, that treating the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, et cetera, in isolation isn't going to work. But it's interesting because one would expect that the indifference that the American public seems to exhibit towards questions of war and foreign policy to play in both directions. So why is it, if war is not going to be the number one issue, if they say the economy is the number one issue, why does that have to play to the advantage of the neocons and the war hawks as opposed to the advantage of the party of peace? And for precisely the reasons that Kevin mentions, namely that war is very bad for the economy, one would kind of expect that the fact that the American people has a different set of priorities would tend to be helpful to the pro-peace side of things. It doesn't work out that way because, of course, elections and what the people want is really only half or perhaps even less than half of the story of what goes on in our government. What's vitally important, for example, are the staff that Congress members have. Who is filling those positions? Where are they getting trained? Where are they getting credentialed? There's an elite level in this conflict as well as a popular level. And while we have, I think, a number of fairly clear ideas about where we want to go at the grassroots level in terms of putting together a broad coalition that can connect the problems of our economy and the problems of our foreign policy, there's also this elite level at which we have to fight as well. The neoconservatives did exactly that, and they did it very, very well. You have a number of people. Sarah Palin is not someone who cares about foreign policy, and yet her foreign policy has been defined by a fellow named Randy Scheuneman, who's basically a neoconservative and, in fact, a lobbyist for the Georgian government, former Soviet Georgia. A lot of the lines you were getting from McCain and Palin about sort of challenging Russia were coming from people like Scheuneman. So it's vitally important that in addition to our grassroots approach, we also have people who are esteemed and credentialed within inside circles too, who can take positions in congressional staff and help sort of push people in the right direction. And we're actually seeing this. I know that people like Ron Paul, for example, the congressman from Texas, have very good staffs who are helping them, and we need to see a lot more of that. So I just want to stress that level too is one at which we have to fight our campaign and win.
Yeah, I think part of that elite level, by the way, is bigger than just looking at government. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do with Come On America is to kind of rebrand the anti-war movement to something that can't be ignored, to bring together academics, from various disciplines that are affected by war policy, who can speak out in a way that provides an intellectual foundation against war, including the economic issues that you and I started to talk about, on it, where is the best way to create jobs and get the economy going. We want to bring together think tanks. There are some strong think tanks who say the right things on war and empire. Historians. There's deep roots in the United States against war, back to George Washington's farewell address, which is so powerful. And you can see those deep roots that in both the conservative and progressive strains of American political thought. And we have a book out called ComeHomeAmerica.us, which you can get on the website, which goes through the history of both conservative and progressive anti-war activism. And so we have a lot to bring to the table, and one of our key challenges is breaking through what I call the fog. You know what the fog is?
Tell them what the fog is.
I used it on Mark's show before. The fog is the forces of greed. And that's what our media shows, the forces of greed that keep this kind of view out of the debate. The New York Times, which is very much a national security favoring newspaper. The Washington Post, which just came out in favor of no withdrawal from Afghanistan. You know, the forces of greed that profit from these wars include the corporate media that keep us out of the debate. We have to redefine the war, anti-war movement, so that it includes the former generals, the former foreign security, the academics, the think tanks, and the activists. So it's top-down, elites to grassroots, working together in a persistent way to say no to war, no to militarism.
Again, I think it's almost time to get folks in the audience out. People have questions and thoughts and ideas you want to bring to this conversation out here?
There's a microphone.
Okay. I'm a retired GAO researcher, and I want to respond to Ralph's mentioning that GAO said that the Pentagon was unauditable. The GAO, the Government Accounting Office, has the responsibility of auditing the books of every federal agency to see whether they're keeping a good track of the money, nothing is disappearing down a rat hole and this kind of thing. For the last, I think, 8 or 9 years, the GAO has been able to audit every agency except the Pentagon and Department of Defense. And the reason why they said that the Pentagon is unauditable is that it's physically impossible to review the bookkeeping and expenditures at the Department of Defense because it's just gibberish, you know, what we're given to audit. So that GAO isn't saying that they're above being audited.
No, of course.
But that it's just impossible to do it because of the way they keep track of money.
The Pentagon itself has no idea, by the way, how much it spends on, you know, everything that it spends money on. So that's exactly right. It's literally just an accounting and physical impossibility for anyone to know exactly where the billions and billions of dollars that go into the Department of Defense wind up.
I mean, in today's paper, there was a piece, and several papers say there was articles about between $13 and $67 billion missing in Iraq that no one can account for, don't know where it went. Certainly didn't go into rebuilding Iraq. The question is, where is it? So that those kind of questions are just universal in this.
It goes to the larger question. Is we have an unaccountable government. The president is not accountable. No matter what they do, they have surrounded themselves with all kinds of immunities so that the taxpayer can't sue, no standing to sue. They got the two parties rigged. They got the elections rigged. They got the debates rigged. And even their contractors are shielded from most lawsuits, like Blackwater, in that situation where they killed 27 innocent civilians in a square in Iraq. And the following newspaper reports were, where's the law to cover Blackwater? They're not covered by Iraqi war law. They're not covered by U.S. They've fallen into the cracks. The Justice Department running around trying to find something to cling to in the federal statutes. And, of course, the government officials. How many people have been prosecuted for the atrocities in Afghanistan and in Iraq? They're not even prosecuted for atrocities by male soldiers against female soldiers. Everything is covered up. Everything is immunized. That's what happens. When you're not part of the risk, you're going to be part of the abuse. When you're not part of the risk in terms of being held accountable. And we haven't caught up to that politically or even in terms of public dialogue, that we now have government officials, including a lot of corporate officials contracting, that are immune from the law, period. And where they might be possibly liable, they can put their corporate law firms on and scare the heck out of the Justice Department in terms of draining the few lawyers in the Justice Department working on this, and so they settle out or they have some deferred prosecution deal. This is extremely serious, and we need to explore it. But if it doesn't get into the electoral or political arena, it will not change. The only change for American people is going to be starting in the electoral and political arenas. That's where they have a vote. That's where they have some elbow room. That's where they can't be totally denied. And if you want to start the place that the change can occur, 535 members of Congress. who put their shoes on like you and I do every day. You change Congress, everything begins to change.
We have a question right over here to the right.
Okay. So, Kelly, you talked about Obama's change of heart. For those of us who worked on the Nader for President campaigns, we knew he had no change of heart, like Kevin said. And I would encourage everyone to go to votenader.org, which is the campaign website from 2008. We called him out in 2008. He didn't have a change of heart. As Kevin says, this is the way he was right from the beginning. And I would say that I have a question also about the peace groups and where they are. I want Kevin to answer that. Where are the mainstream peace groups? But as of right now, I would say that I would agree with the American conservative more than I would agree with the mainstream peace groups. Because from what I can tell, because they're hooked with the Democratic Party and Obama, they're gagged. And so I think we've got to go beyond Democrat and Republican, go beyond conservative and liberal, and just create a coalition of activists who call it as they see it. So I agree with Dan McCarthy more than I agree with the peace groups and more than I agree with the Democratic Party. And don't fall for the line that Obama's had a change of heart. Visit votenator.org, the 2008 campaign website, where we call them out.
Well, and the reason why I brought that up the reason why I think it's salient now is that we're seeing stories about Republicans coming out and saying that they're against the war in Afghanistan. And my point was, this is the same thing we heard from Democrats during the last, election cycle or during the 2008, that they opposed the war in Iraq. They wanted to bring the troops home. We have to look a little deeper to the surface. Are they Ron Paul Republicans who have always been against the war, who's against the neo-colonial imperialistic thrust of the war, or are they just against Obama and they're against the way Democrats are waging the war? And I'm just saying, let's not, we need to go into the next election clear-headed, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. Look at what their motives are, what the agenda is. Are they against war, preemptive war, interventionist policy, or are they just against the political, the people who are in charge of this war?
I mean, President Obama, I think, when he was running for office, one of his big applause lines was, I'm going to end the war in Iraq. He meant by that, he's going to remove combat troops or relabel combat troops into non-combat troops, and they can still be fighting the war, called an occupation instead. Because, as I said, we still have 100,000 troops and private mercenaries fighting the war that Obama ended, and people are still dying both sides in that war. As far as the peace groups goes, there was a survey done of the peace groups at a conference in Albany about a year ago, and what they found was the majority were Democrats. And I do think that has muted the peace movement. We saw it in 2008, we saw it in 2004, in the Kerry campaign, we saw supposed anti-war Democrats being very quiet when President Obama said he's going to expand the war in Pakistan or attack in Pakistan and expand the war in Afghanistan. Now he's going to leave a residuary force in Iraq. You didn't hear much complaints from the peace movement even then, and you see less of it even now. And so I think that's another reason why we have to do a more of an across-the-board thing that is focused on the issue and independent of the parties. I would disagree with Ralph on one thing. It doesn't start with Congress. It starts with building an independent movement. And that's where we are. The elections are a fraud in this country. We get to choose between two corporate-approved candidates, and that's what we get to choose from. It's an oligarchic system that is not really it's a manipulated democracy, much like the Iraq democracy is manipulated by an electoral commission that gets to say who runs for office, much like the Iranian democracy is manipulated by the religious leaders who get to pick who runs for office there. We have corporations deciding who runs for office here, and it's a manipulated fake democracy. We have to start from building a movement. And it needs to be an independent movement away from both parties that stands for independent movement, independent electoral system, and independent media. Because we have to have all three of those, and then we can talk about remaking the government. But we have to start even below the step of making the government over.
Well, and just to put a number on it, there was, I know, Medea Benjamin and Charles Davis just had a story last weekend about, you know,
the makeup of the peace movement.
Right, and there was a survey done, a study done, and 54% of, you know, so-called anti-war activists had, you know, had been self-described Democrats a year ago or during the Obama election. Today, it's less than a quarter.
And those people left the movement and have stopped being peace advocates.
Right. So all of a sudden, they don't need to be anti-war anymore because a Democrat is in the White House.
Right.
So were they really anti-war to begin with, or they just didn't like Bush?
Exactly.
You know, so it's kind of scary.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Coming up in the second hour of today's show, we'll be back with more from the Come Home America panel, taped live at Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets on Sunday night. Don't go away. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.